I'd like to call it Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division order. For the members that are here, if you'd scan your minutes of the previous meetings, so we could get a motion to approve them somewhere during, as we get a quorum. And actually, this afternoon, we're going to just have overviews. The Metropolitan Council and the Department of Transportation will be reviewing our budget proposals, and we do have the proper people here that we're glad to have them, and I'm sure we can move quickly if we can go. I'd just like to, for temporary, for the members of the committee that are here, we do have a page now. We're back in duty, and it's Andy Kropik. And I did. Where's Andy now? Oh, Andy, if you just stand up, so they know who our page is. So for the members, we do have that, and it's nice to have you, Andy. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bell. It's a chair of the Metropolitan Council. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Chair Leader. We will be brief in our presentation today. There are a number of areas that we want to touch on. We would like to provide the committee with an overview of the current status of our transit budget, particularly since the last legislative session. We thought committee members would have a strong interest in our ridership, particularly with North Star recently opening. We also, as the committee members are aware, opened the 35W or elements of the 35W system as well, BRT system. We're also going to provide an overview of the Central Corridor, an issue that has generated a fair amount of attention lately, both on the positive as well as not so positive side, and I want an opportunity to update the committee on that, and finally to talk about the Southwest Corridor. To provide the budget update, Wes Cloistra will do that. He is the CFO of the council, and I would ask Mr. Cloistra to come forward and give the committee a topside overview of the status of our transit budget to date.
Thank you, Chair Bell. For the members, I believe there was a handout came from the Metropolitan Council that you have in your packet, or not in your packet, was a handout. So it should be there. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Cloistra, was that right?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, it's Wes Cloistra.
Cloistra, okay.
I want to begin with the budget overview by speaking a little bit to what happened during the last session. And as you recall, there were some changes in law, but there were also some commitments that you asked that we make as an organization relative to those changes, and Chair Bell articulated those commitments to you in a letter after session was over, and they included that fare increases and service reductions to the transit system would be looked at as a last resort, that you provided us levy flexibility, but that we would try to limit our use of that levy flexibility, and that included 50% of livable communities levies, which also includes demonstration account levies and tax-based revitalization account levies, as well as providing us access to 75% of the right-of-way acquisition loan fund levies, and then finally allowing us to use for transit purposes return balances in the livable communities funds. These would be balances that were of grants that were let out and were in the end not used and returned back to the agency. As far as specific session outcomes last year, as you recall, we came to you with a deficit for the biennium in excess of $62 million. You did provide us with an acceleration of the Minnesota vehicle sales tax share. You accelerated our share by 1.5% in state fiscal year 10 and another 1.5% in state fiscal year 11 up to a value of $12.75 million. That was then offset by a reduction in state general fund appropriations to the council of $13 million. I should point out that the acceleration by its nature was a one-time acceleration over those 2 years, and the reduction in our general fund base was long-term or an ongoing reduction. We also experienced unallotments by the governor of in 2009 of $3.2 million. That represented about 2.25% of our general fund base. And then most recently, the governor's asked us to hold back 3% of that base. While there's not been action on that amount, we are holding back $3.2 million for the biennium in response to the governor's request. And then finally, we were asked to absorb the state's share of rail operations, which is for the biennium, almost $15 million. About $5 million of that was for additional costs of the Hiawatha line. And then the remaining $10 million was for North Star operations that began in November of this year. We have also seen, since last session, changes to the MBEST forecast. It's been the story of our funding for some time because, as you recall, the forecast has been on a downward decline and collections have been on a downward decline for some time. Our current collections, the November forecast increased anticipated collections over the February forecast, and currently we're at 103%, a little over 103% of the November forecast in current collections. I should point out that also includes, that 103% also includes the impact of cash for clunkers. So we're not really sure exactly how that's going to play out in the end. We do know that it increased our collections early in the biennium when Cash for Clunkers program was active, and we're still seeing what kind of lingering effects it will have over the year. I'd also like to point out about MBEST that we seasonally adjust, actually monthly adjust, anticipated receipts, and this is based upon 10 years of experience or more of MBEST collections, and I can tell you that it's highly volatile. We've had some months where we've only been 90% of what was anticipated is to be collected that month. We've had other months where we've been 120% of what's anticipated to be collected from MBEST. So that's a 30% swing from month to month over what's anticipated. And so the point being is we're still looking at that very closely. We're not sure where MBEST will be by the time we get to the end of the year and going into next year. And I've already referenced as what's shown on the slide, issues around the cash for clunkers and needing to have that play itself out. Although we think we've seen the impact of it, we'll see over time how that changes collections over the year. This is a chart of a recent forecast of MBEST revenues. The green line that you see represents the November of 2005 forecast. Obviously, the actual receipts are shown on the black line. Actual receipts fell well short of what were anticipated in November of 2005. Then the royal blue line shows the forecast that was adjusted in November 2007, and you can see once again that actual revenues fell well short of forecast. The decisions made by this body were based upon the February forecast of 2009. That's shown on the purple line. And you see by the red line, which is the most recent forecast, there's been an adjustment upward from the February forecast. So they're anticipating improved collections on the Minnesota vehicle sales tax receipts over the coming years. In saying that, I would like to point out that our last year of actuals, which is the last black, the end of the black line, the $122.8 million, is still lower than what we received in 2004. So as Chair Bell said often, we're getting an ever-increasing share of an ever-shrinking pie when it comes to the MBEST collections. I would also point out that while you see an upward curve in the actual collections, that is entirely an artifact of the fact that we're getting an increased share of MBEST over that time. If you were to look at the state forecast for MBEST still shows still show declining collections, and we are according to the forecast at the bottom of that trough, and the forecast is in the future suggesting that we will see increasing collections in MVEST. Given what's happened in previous forecasts, we're watching this with a lot of caution, because they've been showing MVEST increasing for many forecasts in past years, and it hasn't played itself out yet. So I just want to make sure that it's clear that while we're showing some increase in MVEST collections, that's entirely a result of our increased share. MVEST collections for the state are still going down. The forecast suggests we're in the trough today. We're at the end of the trough today, but we'll see in the coming months, in the coming years, whether that's true.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Just real quickly on the 2010 numbers, the 124.7 and up to the 135.3, how much of that is attributed to the moving around of the acceleration of the MVEST and the general fund backfill, and how much is it just growth in the projections? Do you know?
Mr. Questor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe that actual growth in MVEST for the biennium, I have the biennium figure, but as a result of increased collections, represents about $12 million of the biennial growth. The rest is represented by our increasing share. I believe that's your question.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you.
Representative Dipke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment. I know the MVEST revenues from sales of automobiles, licensing, and gas. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So I would assume that this curve that you're experiencing is not any different than a lot of other sales tax items, that because of the economy, certainly back in 2004 when we peaked at 127.7, that's when gas was reasonably low. And then we go into just before the general elections in 2008, when we see a low, that's when gas was at $4 a gallon and so forth. And then there's a correlation with that in unemployment. People are not buying gas, they're not buying as many cars except for the cash for clunkers. And then you're seeing an increase in ridership in transit, in other words, buses and trains and things like that. So if you took a look at maybe some of the other sales tax areas, you'd see a similar thing, I'm guessing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the decline, first of all, the MVEST collections is based upon motor vehicle sales, and that includes used car sales. Mm-hmm. It's not included on the licensing side. Mm-hmm. Of the equation. The MVEST, and I regret not bringing the longer state actuals chart, but you would see that MVEST collections has been declining since 2004. So it happened well ahead of this recession. Maybe it was a leading indicator. I don't know that, but it happened well ahead of this recession and has declined dramatically. And in recent years, it's still declining, and one would expect that in relationship to the recession, but the decline was well before that, and that's what causes us to have some skepticism with regard to the projected increase in motor vehicle sales in the future. Now, I guess one would suggest that at some point pent-up demand has to release itself, but I'm not quite sure that it's ready to do that or not. We'll see. We're still in a declining mode, and that's a message I want to get across, and it's been for some time, 2004.
Be interesting to see between 2004. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr.
No,
Chair.
Representative Depke.
Yes, it would be interesting to see a correlation between maybe the price of gas also, you know, to see how it affects. But thank you very much.
I'd just like to call the meeting to order. We are official now. We have a quorum, so we're okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in addition to the changes by the legislature last year and the commitments that we made with regard to the flexibility given, we also made a number of administrative interventions. So,
excuse me, sir. Representative Hortman, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, did you want somebody to move the minutes?
Oh, fine. Excuse me.
I can wait.
Well, as long as you're this close.
You had asked at the beginning. And
right. And there are four of them, aren't there?
I've skimmed them all. Can I move adoption of all of the minutes in the packet?
Thank you. Any questions or comments, additions? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? Minutes are approved. Sorry, we've got the official business out of the way now. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk a little bit about administrative interventions that have also been implemented since last session. These, of course, were necessary if we were going to avoid fare increases and if we were going to avoid service reductions and certainly with the declining revenues and limited use of the livable communities money. But one of the administrative interventions we placed on the system was that we were going to be on a preservation-only budget. That means we were going to try to preserve the services that we were currently providing in the regional area, but we were not going to look at any expansion across the metropolitan region in terms of transit services. There is one exception to that, and that was expansion that was committed prior to making this decision, and much of that expansion was supported by other dollars that were committed by either the federal government or other local units of government. And those included the North Star operations, which was a significant expansion. It included UPA, which was primarily centered in the South Metro along the 35W corridor and Cedar Avenue corridor, and a small CMAC project, which was a Guardian Angels Park and Ride. In addition, we continued services that were initiated during the collapse of the 35W bridge to the northern section of the metro region, and because there was a significant demand that was created by that, we closed the temporary park and rides, but there was much more use of the existing park and ride, and we continued service there. So those were the exceptions to the preservation-only budget approach.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Koister, could I just clarify a couple things from what you just said? Did MetTransit increase fares from the end of last session to today?
Mr. Koister.
Mr. Chair, no, they did not.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, did MetTransit cut any service from the end of session to today?
Mr. Chair, the service changes that we would have made would have been as a matter of, and Mr. Lamb can speak better this than I, but I'll give it a shot. As a matter of practice, we will stop services that are not on performing routes and add services on performing routes. The commitment we made on no service reductions was made with respect to no service reductions to what we would typically refer to as performing routes. There may have been service reductions made to routes that were simply not, there was simply low demand for. We would have made those changes in any environment, even in an expansion environment, we would have likely made those changes.
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Koister, thank you. And I can also defer to Mr. Lamb on questions that I might be going beyond your expertise. Mr. Koister, are you familiar with the 5311 funds and the Dial-A-Ride program and the proposal that Met Council submitted?
Mr. Koister.
Mr. Chair, I'm familiar with the subject in general, but I'm not familiar with the specifics.
Would it be better that I ask either Commissioner Bell or Mr. Lamb about that? I'm interested in finding out, Mr. Chair, about expansion of Dial-A-Ride, I believe in maybe some suburban areas that Met Council works with, and use of what's called federal 5311 funds in order to expand Dial-A-Ride opportunities. Am I right in understanding that Met Council made that proposal?
Chair Bell, is this going to interfere with your continuing? Otherwise, is someone else going to pick this? And again, I'm not. I just want to make certain we aren't running in a duplication.
No, Mr. Chair, we were not intending on addressing this specific issue. I think that we can do it relatively quickly. In terms of the Dial-A-Ride services, we spend about $4.3 million on an annual basis for our Dial-A-Ride system. And what we found throughout the seven-county area is that system was not operating the same in one part of the seven-county region as was in other parts of the seven-county region. And we get some of those dollars for a Dial-A-Ride service from the FTA, and in an audit that they conducted, one of the areas of criticism is the lack of the same approach throughout our catchment area. One example, perhaps the best illustration of that, is that when you use any federal funds, you have to use them for the whole population. You cannot segregate and say, we are going to target some of our services, for instance, toward seniors with our dial-a-ride system. And the dial-a-ride system exists where our regular route system does not operate. There was also a great deal of inefficiencies that we found in the system in terms of what was charged, who was charged, fares, and the like. So Mr. Weaver and myself instructed staff to do a restructuring of our dial-a-ride service, and the net total of that restructuring was really an expansion of the dial-a-ride service within the envelope of the $4.3 million, or broadly within that. Reduce the number of vendors that there were to, I think we have three or four vendors now that will be providing service across the region, and then to have uniform standards of delivery so the same type of service will be provided to the same individuals. For instance, we had in some of our dial-a-ride areas regular route bus service in very close proximity to where dial-a-ride was. Other parts, there was no dial-a-ride service and no regular route, and we thought that that was an inequity that needed to be addressed. Understandably, those parts of the region that lost service or had reduced service are quite concerned and have made their concerns felt. And those that receive services, they're pleased and are grateful, but have not made nearly the same, I guess, amount of verbal congratulations for that being extended to them. I absolutely think it was the right thing to do. I'm committed. I'm glad that we have done that and feel that that was the right course of action. In terms of the 5311 monies, those are federal dollars that come into this region. Those 5311 dollars are to be spent in the rural parts, really, of the entire state. And what was happening previously is the 5311 dollars, very few of those dollars were staying in the seven-county area. Many of those were going into greater Minnesota. And yet and still, we have many parts of the seven-county area that are considered rural. And so we felt that we should, the metropolitan region, should have access to the 5311 dollars that were intended for rural areas, and that we could use some of those 5311 dollars for the rural parts of the seven-county metropolitan area. And we did. And I think we worked out an agreement with MnDOT. I think there was a transfer in of about $800,000 or $900,000 in that area. I know it was south of $1 million. But these were federal dollars. They were to go for rural transit. Historically, for a number of reasons, the seven-county area did not receive dollars for the rural portion of transit operations here, and we felt that was an inequity that needed to be addressed.
Representative, Mr. Shetland, Mr. Chair, if I might, thank you. Commissioner, I don't disagree with much of what you said. I might have a quibble here or there. And I believe that Met Council has an obligation to provide transit throughout the metropolitan area, and I wouldn't even disagree that you've got some rural areas that you need to serve. The reason I brought it up at this point, Mr. Chair, was that we heard about whether there was expansion of service or not. I would argue this was an attempt to expand service, expand dial-a-ride service in rural areas of the seven-county metro. Commissioner, I appreciate that you said 5311 monies that had otherwise or in the past gone to the other 80 counties is now being spent in part in the seven counties. Again, I'm not trying to draw that divide, but there was an expansion of service. At the same time that there was not an expansion of service in the other 80 counties because of the deficit, in which there were increases in fares in the other 80 counties that, of those that even have transit, and you and I both know I represent a county that doesn't even have transit. So it concerns me a little bit. I defend that you don't cut service. I defend that you don't raise fares. I'll even defend that you expand transit. But let's not mistake that that's not the situation in the other 80 counties. In the other 80 counties, we don't have service, or we had cut service, or we had increased fares. So I have one more question, because I don't disagree with what you said. In Minnesota law, MnDOT has a goal, is told to have a goal of meeting 80% of unmet transit service needs. For the area that Met Council covers, what is the goal when it comes to unmet transit service needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not able to quote that. I'm not sure, to be candid with you, in law, if we have a goal that specifies that. We do have a goal to double our transit service by 2030 and to grow it by 50% by 2020. We are largely on pace to do that. But in terms of statute, I'm not sure if we have a goal like to meet 80% of the transit need or 90% of it. Maybe Mr. Shetland knows. I know we have an internal policy of 50% by 2020, 100% growth of our transit system by 2030, and that is the goal that we make very public and we hold ourselves accountable for.
And Mr. Chair, and members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And I appreciate the comments. The council, as Chairman Bell expressed, that is our goal. The council has a goal. I do not believe it is in statute. However, going back to the fare increase that you were talking about, one of the things that we negotiated last year at the end of session was the fact that the council had just undertaken an across-the-board fare increase in October of 2008. And at all costs, they wanted to avoid a fare increase and service reductions in the face of a $62.4 million shortfall. So one of the things that the council brought to the table and worked with the House and the Senate on was to allow us to use different levies that would allow us to make things somewhat whole. We did take a cut in our general fund base. However, that was made up with some one-time money, which was great, but it's still a cut to our base, which is of concern to us. But when we talk about the Dollar Ride program, as Chairman Bell mentioned, yes, there was some changes made with the 5311 funds. The council made a request for those dollars through MnDOT, and one of the criteria that the FTA uses when they hand out those dollars is based on population, and based on the roughly 11 or so million dollars that come in out of those funds, you know, just north of $1 million of that was generated within the metropolitan area, and we felt that would be a good opportunity for us to take a look at our Dial-A-Ride program and move forward with it. You'll remember also last spring that the council came forward with a bill that Representative Hornstein carried for us that we talked about restructuring the Dial-A-Ride program, and it was determined that we didn't need the legislation to do that, but we wanted to make the committee and the legislature very well aware that this is something that we were considering. So I want to make sure that that you recognize and remember the fact that we were back here to do that, and one of the things that we looked at was the 5311 funds, and Representative Morrow, there is not a greater advocate for Greater Minnesota Transit. I understand that this, as this was going on over the summer, that it was sort of an issue for you, but we also, there was a number of letters exchanged between yourself and Chairman Leader to talk specifically about this issue, and, mm-hmm. and we obviously are a transit organization and care about transit, not just in the metro, but statewide, but how those 5311 dollars have been shared over the course of the past many, many years. The council was just getting a fraction of the amount of dollars that was generated within the metro, so we thought it would be to our benefit to go forward and do that and try to apply that to our reorganized Dial-A-Ride program.
And Mr. Chair, one point, if I might. I think it is important that the committee take into context in this discussion really what I think the significant efforts the council made to balance our budget in the last legislative session. We were $63 million in the hole. We took a hit in our general fund allotment. And in essence, we solved, or we worked with this body and the Senate and the governor to solve our problem by reprioritizing some of our livable community dollars, using some RRA funds and the like. That I believe did a very good job in dealing with a very, very deep hole. I can't speak to the issues in Greater Minnesota and the transit systems there and what kind of juggling they have to do, but this committee should not be left with the impression that we were not affected by the downturn in the economy and the downturn in tax receipts. We were, to the tune of $63 million. That was a very heavy hit for us.
Representative Morrow. And Mr. Chair, I'll keep it short. I want to be really clear. I am not questioning what you did. I think it's great that you were able to do the things you said. So, since you think I'm questioning your application, I'm not.
Not at all.
I'm saying, I'm trying to highlight a very significant issue for at least 80 counties. In that, the reality is, you've been a tremendous advocate for transit, and you've been able to do a great job in getting funding. I want to make it very clear that when you talk about you didn't have to cut service, you didn't have to raise fares, Mr. Shenden, I know you talked about 2008, that wasn't the reality in the rest of the state, and that we are, in some points, competing for the same money.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Merle, thank you for raising that issue. MnDOT's, apparently, as I understand the statute, responsible for 80% of the unmet need in rural transit, and those are the fuzzy words I'd like to hear us engage someday.
Yes.
What in the heck is unmet need, and how is it defined? Is there an empirical formula that actually gives us a hard number? And that's not your question, Chairman Bell, but I see a couple of my MnDOT friends in the front row here. Perhaps when they give their testimony, if they want to take a stab at it, or if we can hold that for a transit discussion another day, I'd like to know just what does that statute mean, and how then do we actually comply with it? So no further explanation or answer necessary. We can hear it later.
Thank you. No further question. You may proceed, Mr. Questra.
Thank you. Moving on with administrative interventions, also during the 2010-11 biennium, we had administrative reductions over the biennium with a value of about $13 million in order to solve our problem. We used ARRA funds on a one-time basis of $17.6 million. All these interventions were in part brought before you as we were discussing the budget last session, but they have been implemented. We have transferred a portion of our general purposes levy. This is a levy that is a council levy towards transit purposes with a value of $3.1 million. And we have currently budgeted for 2010 a limited use of livable community funds of $3.4 million. In keeping with our commitment to the legislature, if MVEST performs consistently with where it's performed the last 6 to 8 months, which is admittedly a big if, we may not need to use all of that $3.4 million in livable communities dollars. But currently, for 2010, we needed to budget that. So of the money monies that were made available to us, which was significantly more than the $3.4 million, we've only had to budget the $3.4 million. And again, that's in keeping with the commitment we made to the legislature. Whoops, I just made a mistake. Sorry. So as a bottom line for 2010-11 biennium, our funding appears sufficient, and we will not be bringing a request to the legislature for additional funds. Again, this is a reminder that that's based on a preservation budget. We have reserves that do meet targets. We do have ongoing revenues that exceed ongoing expenditures that exceed our revenues, and that is made up for with the use of some of the one-time funding that's available to us. Our levy, livable communities levy, the ARRA funds. I believe in 2010 we're scheduled to use about $22 million of one-time funds to balance our budget. That improves over time, but that improvement over time is again based upon an MBEST forecast that is going up. So our future is hinging a bit on a forecast that we have some skepticism about.
Mr. Koester, Representative Hortman.
Thanks. Just a real quick question. On the previous slide, the transfer of general purpose levy collections, if you can just say a word about it. Is that a property tax transit levy that you're going to change how you would normally use it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. One of our levy categories is called general purposes levy. It's not per se a transit levy. It is a levy that has flexibility to be used across all council needs. And in this case, we applied $3.1 million of that levy to transit. Now, I should say as a matter of clarification that we also reduced other parts of our levy so that the total levy to the property tax, the total property tax levy attributable to the council did not increase as a result of this. We were able to reduce other levies because there were balances in the accounts that we typically would apply those levies to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, it's where my salary gets paid.
Chair Bell, if I may interject, I think we're going to be pushing the clock a little bit. And if you, I think maybe some of your testimony is probably beyond the budget. If we could just clear up the budget portion, that'd be fine. I'm looking at the rest, I think that's maybe for another time if that's okay. Because I don't think you're going to, I think we could run the whole period out the way it looks. And we've got some high-priced people sitting behind you.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. We had two additional components to our presentation, one on transit ridership and another one on a status update on Central Corridor and Southwest. We could either come back at another time and do those two, or we could do the status update on Central Corridor or Southwest. I would defer to your judgment.
I was thinking which one would be more current with the budget, and probably that would be Central Corridor.
Central Corridor. Yeah. So perhaps Mr. Cloister could finish his, and then I'll
right.
go through the Central. Okay.
Mr. Chair, now that I understand that I'm eating into Chair Bell's time, I will very quickly finish. The final point I want to make is that the regional transit budget, while appears to be balanced for the biennium, is subject to a great deal of risk in its both its revenues and cost centers. We've talked about the risk in the MVEST. I would say to you that 1% change in MVEST in the MVEST forcast has about a $3 million biennial effect. In fuel pricing, for every 10-cent change in fuel prices for the biennium would be about a $1.5 million cost, or $750,000 a year for every 10-cent increase in fuel prices.
Mr. Cloister, how far ahead do you contract for fuel? Is that yearly or what?
Mr. Chair, we contract between 18 and 24 months ahead for about 80 to 85% of our fuel. And then finally, the reliance on one-time funds, the accelerated MVEST, the ARA, and so forth, does make us more dependent upon the hopefully increasing MVEST forecast. The availabilities of the levies, the flexibility you've given us, expires in 2012. And, of course, we have concerns about overstate funding commitments for North Star. I mentioned that we had to absorb operating costs for North Star for the and the rail increases to Hiawatha. I will say for the first time we've had to apply part of our MVEST collections to rail operations rather than state appropriations. So we're in the point now where MVEST is not only paying for bus service, it's also paying in part for the rail operations. And of course, in the head of us is the Central Corridor that is scheduled to open for service in 2014.
Representative Beard had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, refresh my memory on the constitutional amendment that was passed that raised the sales tax for certain counties. Any of that money go to operations, or is that capital only?
Chair Bell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, there's five counties that participate in that. That provides $85 million approximately on an annual basis. There are two major sources for the use of those funds, one of which is transit capital to pay for new transitway capital. Mm-hmm. So they will be paying 30% of the Central Corridor light rail line, the capital cost of that. And then the second major use of those funds is to pay 50% of the operating costs of transitways that they participate in. All the transitways that a CTIB can fund have to be consistent with our transportation policy plan.
Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbrook.
Just real briefly, because I know you want to move on, would you be willing to provide the committee with some type of tales? I mean, obviously you've laid out lots of gloom and doom, but you don't show us when you actually go into the red again under current funding levels. I mean, you got lots of one-time money here. You've got increasing ridership costs and subsidies. When do you fall off the cliff again? And, you know, looking out under the November forecast, if you can do your tales, and you're operating so that we know you're okay for this biennium, but give us some picture of best guess for next biennium.
Mr. Koister?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we have looked at this over multiple years. I would say that we are using reserves mostly in this biennium. The reason we don't rely on reserves in future bienniums that are preserved is because of the increase, forecast increases to the motor vehicle sales tax. So if the motor vehicle, I will get you the information you requested, but if the motor vehicle sales tax performs as it is forecasted, then actually the problem subsides a bit in future years.
You can keep hoping.
Yeah. Representative Holberg, you did indicate that you furnish a breakdown on that, I believe. Is that Mr. Wright, Mr. Koister? Yeah. Are you completed with your testimony?
Mr. Chair.
Or Mr. Koister, I mean? If not, I just want to thank you for appearing. And so we cut you apart once in a while here.
Mr. Chair, if it pleases the committee, I will move quickly toward issues pertaining to the Central Corridor and touch briefly on Southwest and give the committee a topside view of that and then entertain any questions that may come along. First, I've got to get the right slide. Okay, here we go. With the Central Corridor, currently we're in preliminary engineering, Mr. Chair. We have an application in for final design. We received some good news last week where the federal government, the Department of Transportation, is recommending a $45 million allocation in the transportation budget, in President Obama's budget, for this upcoming for fiscal year 11. One important piece of information that was not in the press that I think the committee would be interested in is that the Central Corridor Light Rail Line was the top rated project of the 35 projects that the FTA is reviewing for both what's known as New Starts dollars. That's huge projects like the Central Corridor with a budget slightly in excess of $955 million, and Small Starts projects. That's another FTA a program for projects up to $250 million. There are 35 of these projects in the queue, and the Central Corridor was the highest rated of the 35, receiving a medium-high rating. In addition, Mr. Chair, the FTA has agreed to fund additional dollars along with money that will be coming from the City of St. Paul as well as dollars from the philanthropic community to build the three so-called infill stations. There has been a fair amount of consternation about those as well. No state dollars are going to be going into building those three infill stations, but there will be federal dollars from the City of St. Paul and the philanthropic community. The combined total of the three infill stations is about $16 million, half of that, of course, coming from the federal government. Second point I wanted to make is that we hope to have a full funding grant agreement by the fall of this year. So we hope to go into final design in the next month or two. We will be in final design for 6 or 7 months, and then in August or September of 2010, this year, we hope to get the full funding grant agreement. That would authorize the federal government to start paying us the 50% of the $955 million cost of the project. Prior to that, and this is important for the committee to understand, we will be seeking a number of letters of no prejudice from the FTA. These letters of no prejudice allow us to do advanced construction on the line using 100% local dollars to do advanced construction so that so the project will be able to stay on time and on budget. These letters of prejudice are a common practice with the FTA. There is a small degree of risk. If the FTA were to decide not to fund the project, then those dollars would get expended and we would not be eligible for reimbursement. But it is my understanding that the FTA has never issued letters of no prejudice without providing a full funding grant agreement. So it is important to understand there is a level of risk. I think it is small and manageable, and it will allow the project to not experience the $35 to $40 million costs in delay. Second point I want to raise is one that has gotten a fair amount of public attention lately. There are currently three lawsuits with the project, one by Minnesota Public Radio, a number by a number of community groups on the east side of the line, as well as a continuing lawsuit with the University of Minnesota. It is very important to note that lawsuits across the country are the norm rather than the exception. There are few major projects of this nature that are built anywhere in the country that there is not some litigation. Nonetheless, they are troublesome. The FTA has indicated to us these lawsuits will not prevent us from going into final design, the phase of the project that we hope to reach in the next two or 3 months. I am less confident that they would not have an impact on our getting a full funding grant agreement. I want to summarize very quickly these lawsuits and at least how we view them. We plan on defending against them. To say vigorously would be an understatement. The one with NPR was based upon a mitigation agreement that we signed with NPR on April 4th, 2009. It's important for the committee to understand I didn't think we should do MOUs. I thought this did not make sense to go down that road. The NPR demanded that we did an MOU. We agreed to do an MOU. And now they are suing us based upon that. They're essentially accusation is a breach of contract. They want us, and I can get into the technical issues, to do what's known as a GERB slab on springs rather than a floating slab on rubber. They have indicated or have asserted that we have a breach of contract, and I want to take two points out of the MOU that speak to this, because I think they are self-explanatory. There is no context which this could be interpreted any other way, in my judgment. The first one, this is out of the MOU now, verbatim. The council agrees to install a floating slab or its performance equivalent for approximately 700 feet along the full length of the NPR Broadcast Center. Further, and I think this is the more important statement, without committing to a specific solution, I don't know what could be clearer, because final engineering is not yet underway, the council will consider as one alternative a low-tuned slab that floats on a spring mechanism comparable to the GERB engineering solution. What we committed to was looking at this GERB floating slab, considering it, but we said very clearly, without making a specific commitment, we have done an analysis that indicates that floating slab, the GERB slab, is inferior to the one that would be a rubber floating slab. It is the one that we are planning on putting on Washington Avenue at the University of Minnesota. Its costs range from $1 to $1.5 million less. We think that this is the appropriate way to go. It will meet the specifications we have agreed to in the MOU, and it will save the project $1 million. Further, Mr. Chair, there is, I think, a very important, really, policy question here. It would be inappropriate for us to really allow interested parties along the line to, in effect, engineer major portions of the line. The question, the public policy question I have is if we were to acquiesce to NPR's demand and the GERB slab didn't work and we had to dig it up, who would pay for that? Not to mention the $1 to $1.5 million, but if it didn't work, who would be responsible for that? All along the line, there would be interested parties who would want to substitute their engineering judgment for the engineering judgment of the professionals that work in the Central Corridor Project Office. That would be a huge concern of mine. Moving to the community groups, there are a number of concerns here that the litigation is based on. One is business mitigation. And this is to deal with issues when particularly construction is going on. A second is gentrification. There's a concern that the economic development that will accompany the Central Corridor line will increase property values and the like and cause gentrification, which is embodied in the third point. And parking is a major concern, particularly the elimination of parking along University Avenue. I've included in your packet of information a list of demands from the community groups. These demands are in excess of $50 million. Some of them, I would leave it to your own judgment about the legitimacy of the various demands. There's a couple of points I think it is important to note. One, most of the concerns of the community groups go beyond the scope of the Met Council or the project. For instance, parking at the end of the day is the responsibility of the city of St. Paul. Much of the economic development that happens on the line is the responsibility of the city of St. Paul. The community groups would like property tax abatements. So if the value of a house goes up, they want to be held harmless. I think it would be for other policymakers to determine, would that set a dangerous precedent across the state if you allowed groups to be protected from the increased cost of the value of their property. We are, however, going to take, and we will be announcing shortly, some stepped-up efforts around business mitigation, which I think are very legitimate issues that that we need to do. And also, we will be putting forward some proposals in the not-too-distant future on issues of economic development. In terms of the University of Minnesota, Mr. Chair, I will be brief. We have made progress with the U, though I've been saying that for about 9 months now. We still do not have an agreement with the U. We have made progress. The major concerns along Washington Avenue have to do with vibrations that will be caused by the train that have the potential to disturb with very sensitive research and research equipment that the university is conducting. There is also a major concern at the university for what is known as EMI, electromagnetic interference. And that results from two things. One, large bodies of metal passing at various speeds. And then, of course, when the two trains pass each other, that also enhances this EMI, and it can be harmful to research and research equipment. I am glad to say that the university and the Met Council have virtually got agreement on the standards for EMI and for vibration. So what are the standards we will engineer and construct that mall to so that the train will cause vibration only at a certain level in EMI? That's a major piece of the puzzle that has largely been solved. Second major piece of the puzzle is monitoring. How will we monitor the vibration and the EMI? There's largely been agreement there. The third piece of the puzzle is in remedies. The university's position is that we should take remedial action if we do not meet the standards. So if the operation of the train doesn't hit those agreed upon standards, we should be taking remedial action. The position of the council is we should take remedial action only based on actual harm, because our concern is we don't want there to be a technical violation of the standard. If it's here, and our performance is right here, but there's no harm to university research. But there's no harm to university equipment. We have significant concerns of spending public dollars. Let's make no mistake of it. We'd be coming back to this body asking you for money so that we could perform back up to that standard. And we think it is problematic to ask for public dollars to remediate to a standard based on a technical violation rather than to actual harm. Nonetheless, we have proposed two compromises to the U. A letter is in your packet. The latest compromise proposal that we make is that if we have a violation of the standards, we would have an extensive process of mediation and consultation. If the university and the Met Council could not agree, we would have that go to binding arbitration. And then you would have a third-party arbitrator say, no, Met Council, you do have to reach that standard, even though there's no harm. Or they'd say to the U, you know what? No harm, no foul. There's no problem with the performance of your research and equipment. We're not going to ask the state to pony up for $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million to correct that. We have not heard back from the university as yet of our compromise proposal. My hope is they will be in agreement with that, and then we will, in essence, have a deal on the standards, on monitoring, and the third position, Mr. Chair, which would be remedial action, or the tripwire for remedial action. We have had extensive negotiations with the U, and we are hopeful that that will resolve the concern. In addition, the U currently is asking for liquidated damages at a price tag of $25,000 a day and injunctive relief, which is essentially their unilateral right to stop the train. Both of those are unacceptable to me. If, in fact, we were to agree to liquidated damages, it's effect putting a gun to our head because that clock of $25,000 a day would be ticking. I think that is not a good use of public money, and I could not allow for that. Nor could I allow the U to unilaterally stop the train.
Chair Bell, I think we should cut it off.
Yes.
I appreciate your coming here. Representative Depke, you had a question quickly.
Thank you, Chairman Meader. I just wanted to ask you, when you're communicating with the university and you say that they have serious concerns, is this through the Board of Regents?
Chair Bell?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, our communication has been with staff. I have requested a meeting with the Board of Regents and have been denied.
Okay, further question?
Well, I just was curious because the legislature appoints the Board of Regents, and so essentially we're responsible for the people that are serving on that board, and I just was feel that I'm very nervous that we're going forward with this and we don't have an agreement with the university on this project. It sounds like it could be a real problem. But I just wanted to make that comment. I just was wondering why we haven't communicated with the Board of Regents, and you answered my question. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair,
Mason, do you have a question? We're really pushing time, and let's sit really short and quickly.
Well, the question is, we're spending a lot. I'm under the impression that we're spending a lot of money on all of the negotiations going on. Was that part of the original estimate, or is this adding on to the cost?
Chair Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did not anticipate or build into the budget. We build in legal costs, but not specifically defending three lawsuits. I want to, the committee, it's important to know, I feel strongly that our case on all three lawsuits is extremely strong. Both the MPR, the language is unambiguous, that we would consider but not commit. I think that the work we have done with the community groups, I've included in your packet an exhaustive but only partial list of what we have done on the corridor, not just us, but the City of St. Paul and Ramsey County, to address many of the concerns by the community groups. And I think the use concerns also we will defend vigorously. And Mr. Chair, given the lateness of the hour, I'd welcome an opportunity to come back in front of the committee and more fully discuss any or all of these issues.
Thank you, Chair Bell. And definitely, we underestimated the time here, and I'm sorry for that. And appreciate all the testimony. Thank you very much. Commissioner Sorrell, I presume. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Sorrell. Sometimes I think it's more difficult to get the MnDOT people here than because they got a bigger geographic territory to hide. But basically, if you could, I think your presentation may not be too difficult.
I don't think it will be. But thank you, Chairman and members. What we want to do today is very briefly talk about the vision we have at MnDOT and our strategic directions, and I know many of you have seen this before, but we want to highlight those and kind of frame our discussion and our overview around those strategic directions, and then we're going to talk about some of our key accomplishments and then some of the key initiatives that we have as we move forward. And I'm going to be tag-teaming with the Deputy Commissioner here, Connie Sahibjan, better known as Connie. As part of the presentation. So just to remind everybody about what we're all about at MnDOT right now, this is the vision that we have. We want to be a global leader in transportation committed to upholding public needs in collaboration with internal and external partners to create a safe, efficient, and sustainable transportation system for the future. And I'd like to highlight that because we use these words global leader in here, and it's an acknowledgement that we need to have a world-class transportation system in our state, and that we're committed to try to deliver that world-class system. There's a key word in here about collaboration. There's a key phrase about collaboration and the need to collaborate internally with our external partners and a recognition of our need to do that. And then creating a safe, efficient, and sustainable transportation system for the future. Those are key words in here as well. And this word sustainable is one very key word in here. I want to talk about that later on in the presentation. The five strategic directions we have at MnDOT: safety, mobility, innovation, leadership, and transparency. These are the five strategic directions that basically guide all the decisions that we make. And the presentation you're going to hear today is pretty much framed around those five strategic directions. Safety, we know we need to be safety as our number one priority. Mobility, we need to address our mobility needs in all that we do. Innovation, we know we need to be a leader in innovation and create a culture of innovation for transportation in our state. Leadership, we embrace the leadership role that we're in for transportation in our state, and I can't say enough about that. We recognize we need to be a leader, we embrace it, and we welcome it as we move forward. In transparency, we recognize the need to be transparent in the decisions we make and to communicate that to all of our stakeholders. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Connie. He's going to talk a little bit about some of our accomplishments this past year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Connie Sahibjan, Deputy Commissioner, Chief Engineer with MnDOT. On this slide, you have the maintenance and operation, and that is our, I'm very proud of that operation. It's our, I call it the bread and butter, is when the guys and ladies are out there fighting the elements. We are proud of what they did during the holiday storm, Christmas Eve to be specific. I happened to go out to one of our truck stations during the shift change at midnight, and they were all proud. Not one complaint from anybody about being there and having to do that work. Just to let you know, in case you're wondering, since we've been dealing with weather the past couple of days, our costs are similar to last year. Last year was a high dollar year for as far as snow and ice control, and this year it's looking like up to now it's going to be pretty high. Up until now, we've spent about $34 million statewide. This is through January 20th. And of that, about $10 million is Metro, and $23 million is Greater Minnesota. It all depends on what happens the rest of the year.
How does that compare to the previous year?
We're a little bit ahead of it, meaning that we've spent a little bit more. Although it depends on what happens in March. March, we get a lot of snow. However, it warms up, and we use less de-icers at that time of the year. So we'll see how that goes. Next, we were involved with the Red River flooding. As all of you know, we were involved at the state level, working with the local agencies there. And also our own crews ended up building a dike along Interstate 94 up there that helped save the road and keep the road open. And I know the commissioner flew up there and visited the site. The third item, as far as operations go, is incident management. When we talk about congestion, of the congestion that you see the numbers, 55% are recurring congestion, which means that it happens every day because of the geometry and what a number of lanes and so on, and the travel demand. 45% of our congestion is because of incidents or other reasons like weather, events, or other things that can cause incidents. Now, congestion. We have a performance measure that we would like to clear a road by within 35 minutes in the metro area, and we've been able to drop that. Our 08 number is 37 minutes at now, and we've been able to drop that. All bets are off when you end up having situations like a tanker fuel where we have to close the road for hours on 94. We had one in Albertville that was an 8-hour closure, and we had the frozen fish spillage in Brooklyn Center that ended up about 5-hour closure. So I'm not talking about those. So I'm going to move on to the next slide and talk about construction a little bit. And there's three things I wanted to touch on real quick. One is the Chapter 152. Basically, we're moving ahead and working on some major bridge replacements and other projects in that within that bond program. We have about 3.5% of our bridges are in poor condition, and we think it'll be down to about 2.3% by 2013 when we move ahead with some major projects. And this year you will see this coming construction season, we'll be starting on the Hastings Bridge, some of the notable ones, bigger ones, Lafayette Bridge right here on 52. And then in the future years you have the St. Croix River crossing and Dresbach down in District 6 and the Cayuga project right out here on 35E. The American Recovery Act, that, as you know, brought $500 million to the state, $350 of it came to MnDOT and $150 to local agencies as far as road projects go. And those projects are all on track. We have the dollars are all obligated, and we're going ahead with that. I won't mention the numbers and going into numbers unless you have questions about it later. We have resurfaced about 1,000 miles of roadway and replaced and rehabilitated about 81 bridges and much guardrail work and all kinds of repair work. And our new road and our the biggest project was a 610 project, which is a new roadway system. Other major projects to note is the UPA project and the crosstown that's still under construction, which will be done this coming year. Construction season. We had the St. Cloud Bridge that, if you recall, was closed because of the gusset plate issues, and that's completed. And also the 169 project through St. Peter. That one was also. That's the picture, I believe, on the slide. We tore up that town for a summer, and businesses did a great job dealing with us. This slide, we're very proud of this. Every time we have an opportunity, we show that. Safety is very important, as you see, and the commissioner may mention safety. Talk about that a little bit later as an initiative. But when we changed the way of doing business back in 2003, you can see how that number of fatalities has started to drop, and we're proud to say that it has dropped again this year down to 425, it looks like, and it's estimated. And our goal is to be down below 400 next year. We are a leader in this in the, nationally. Again, I'm proud to say ASHTO is working on a strategic, new strategic direction, strategic plan, and one of their strategic plan is to cut fatalities in half by 2030. And I personally am working on a work group, leading a work group to develop that and working nationally on that. They recently invited us to a national scan of us and five other states to talk about road departure issues, and we have a person that's going to that. My last slide is other accomplishments is transit. We are and we want to be and we are advocates of Greater Minnesota Transit. I know you had some discussions earlier. We've delivered $45 million in federal and state grants to 64 transit systems statewide. Those funds enabled 33 transit systems to purchase replacement buses, and three of the systems advanced bus garage projects. I also would some of you may know that we are literally, it may be happening now, or if not today, tomorrow, releasing a transit plan. That's been we've been waiting to publish that, so that will be released here. It may already be released. And then also, I would like to mention the rail plan. You all heard there was a joint committee meeting with the House and the Senate to present the rail plan, the high-speed rail plan, the freight and passenger rail, and I think you all heard about that, and we are very proud of that effort. And the last piece is about aeronautics in our airports. More than $65.5 million of federal money and $9 million of state dollars was used for 190 airport projects, and all the work included new terminal construction, runway resurfacing, and fuel system upgrades and general maintenance. So with that, I know you're running a little short in time. I'd like to hand it back over to the commissioner to talk about initiatives, unless you have any questions from me.
A brief comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking on the accomplishments here with roadway fatalities and a precipitous drop, a good drop. This is perhaps too involved to deal with tonight, but at some point I'd like to have them back and we can talk about what they attribute that to, because we may want to think about the money we're spending, where it's having the biggest effect, so on and so forth. So no answer required now, but Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have them back sometime and talk about that, okay?
Okay. I think that may be hit in public safety a little bit too, won't it, I believe?
Right. Now I'm going to say a few words about that here.
Okay. Commissioner, yeah.
Just to talk a little bit about some of the key initiatives, and again, we're going to frame this discussion around our five strategic directions: safety, mobility, innovation, leadership, and transparency. From a safety perspective, Connie already mentioned the Towards Zero Death initiative, and we continue to believe this is a critical initiative in the department. We need to be diligent about it. It's a journey, and we've got to recognize and understand that it's a long-term journey that we need to continue down that path on. We attribute some of our success today, this partnership in all four E areas, education, enforcement, engineering, and emergency medical services. It's not just a MnDOT thing. It's not just a public safety thing. It includes all four E's, and that's what's made this a success, the collaborative effort that brought all four of these E's together and developed a comprehensive safety plan that really moved us in these directions. And on that chart that Connie showed you, you can almost look at a point in time when the Towards Zero Death initiative was started, and you'll see that immediate droppage. And so we attribute a lot of our success to the partnership that we have with all four E's. We also attribute a lot of our success of all our roads. This is pretty unique. Not all states do this, but all of our roads are considered in our safety planning activities. The cities, the counties, they all play a big role in the reduction of fatalities in our state. We include those in our planning processes. And lastly, we've moved from a system where we react to crashes to a system where we're proactive,
and we look at systematic solutions. And we think that's a critical piece of our success as well. So, but we'd be happy to come back and have a continuing dialogue about this and share with you more about the TZD initiative, because it's pretty significant. It's recognized nationally as and internationally as a really good effort. I want to say a couple words about ADA implementation, Americans with Disability Act's implementation. About a year ago, I would say we were in trouble with how we addressed ADA in our state. And to try to address some of these difficulties, we formed a collaborative with many of the ADA stakeholders and folks at MnDOT. And we brought them together to start addressing some of these concerns in a collaborative way. And one of the significant things we did just 7 months ago is we developed an ADA transition plan. This was a critical piece to moving the ADA discussion in our state. And we have a draft plan out there now. We've got a public comment period that closed on January 13th. We're looking at all the comments. This is pretty significant. And it's pretty significant to not only us at MnDOT, but for our local folks and the ADA community. So we're pretty proud of that, and we're looking forward to moving forward with that transition plan. Some of the additional things we're doing, we're completing inventories in our districts about ADA needs that are out there. We're developing training for city, county, and state employees. And then we've targeted some funds for standalone improvements for ADA projects in our state, and we're going to make sure that ADA is included in our other projects as well. We've done some pretty unique things here as we move this forward and develop trust with the ADA community. I'll give you a quick example. We struggled with roundabouts and how the ADA community worked through in roundabouts. And so what we did to respond to that, we brought some members of the community to some of our roundabouts and asked them to help us design those roundabouts. We did a road trip, and it was pretty significant, and we learned things that were of interest to the ADA community that we weren't aware of as engineers. So it was a pretty good effort, and I think pretty significant in developing that trust and respect between us and the community. Context-sensitive solutions. This is basically an effort that we've been a national leader in for many years. It's an effort that respects the fact that we want to build our transportation facilities that in a way that fit into the settings they're in. And we're moving forward with some new initiatives in this area. And typically, CSS solutions have been in our design area. We're trying to move them into the entire project continuum from concept to completion. And if we are able to do this, which we think we can, we'll be the first state in the country to do that. But we think this is a really great effort. We're moving forward in this area. And we're also moving forward with the complete streets discussion. We issued a report here not too long ago on complete streets. We're trying to take a leadership role in that area and try to facilitate this complete streets discussion in our state. And we've been working with proposed legislation with all the complete streets stakeholders. And we're trying to accomplish this via a partnership. We think there's an opportunity to form a sound complete street partnership that could move this forward in a way that works for all of us. So we're excited about that as well. An example of context-sensitive solutions, you may have heard or read about this, 169-494 interchange. When we looked at a traditional interchange, one thing we learned were there's some movements in the interchange that weren't absolutely necessary, and we could eliminate a couple of those movements and save $30 to $40 million by doing that. And so an alternative design that we used was a performance-based design in which we would build the interchange in such a way that it would meet current and projected needs, and then when certain performance measures were triggered, we'd go back and look at some solutions. By using this approach, we'll save $30 to $40 million as an approach that we hope to use in other parts of the state as well. Innovative financing. We're exploring a lot of innovative financing approaches and how we might use those in our state. We're trying to take a very methodical approach to this effort and look at it in incremental steps and figure out what works best for Minnesota. We're looking at traditional and non-traditional funding and figure out ways in which we can utilize all sources of fund to help maximize our investment. You may have saw some of our innovative financing project initiatives we announced in October, the Highway 169 and Bren Road interchange in Minnetonka and the Elk Run interchange. Those are some examples of some of the concepts we're looking at. and trying to move those forward as well.
Excuse me, Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And going back to the 169-494 intersection, I've been on that one a lot of times, and the problem as I see it is when you exit 494 to go south on 169, you've got a stoplight not far down the road there, very close to, and I think another one after that.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm trying to get off onto 169, these folks are all stopping for the stoplight, and I can't get on the main road. And so are we going to look at building an overpass for those roads? And then this same thing happens when you come north.
Mm-hmm.
On 169. You're buzzing along with the traffic, and all of a sudden everything's at a screeching halt. So I just wanted to have the chance to talk about that intersection a minute.
Cody?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Magnus, I think you're hitting that's the heart of the project where because of those lights, people back up on the ramp onto the main line, and we've had a fatality there about a year and a half ago where it's not very comfortable sitting there on the right lane and then people buzzing by you 65-70 miles an hour. So that's where you have as we always say in safety, speed doesn't cause accident, the differential in speed does, the difference. So when you people are sitting there, that's exactly what we're going to remove. Yes, there will be flyovers, and we can stop by and show you the layout if you're more interested.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner,
you got an engineering degree. Did you get that South Dakota State?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, yes, I graduated with a bachelor's and master's degree from South Dakota State University.
I know, then I'm confident in your abilities.
Where'd you go, Representative?
Connie, I presume you, one of the problems we have, you're talking again a metro project, and we got a lot of rural people here saying now you're going to spend a lot of more money in the metro. But anyhow, you know, that's always the issue you face.
Mr. Chair, I don't have my metro hat on anymore. I think statewide.
Commissioner?
Okay. Moving on, we wanted to highlight to you our efforts in modal integration and our efforts to restructure our modal planning and program management process. And basically what we're trying to do is reflect our emphasis on becoming a true multimodal planning agency. And Connie mentioned our statewide rail plan and our transit plan. And we really want these plans and these kinds of activities to be integrated within the department organizationally, as well as within our policies and integrated in things like CSS, Complete Streets, all these things that we're talking about, our scoping efforts, our design efforts, and making it a kind of a way of life at MnDOT. And so we're taking a hard look on how we're going to elevate the multimodal efforts of the agency, and we feel we're headed in the right direction there, and make it not just something we think of as an afterthought, but something we think of it as part of the process. So we're looking at all our processes and assessing those processes to see how we can integrate a multimodal element in those processes. I want to highlight the efforts that we've had in the past and what we're trying to do in the future with our workforce and DBE Collaborative. I know there's a lot of interest in this issue. We want to assure you that this is an initiative that we want to continue, that we're going to continue to place high priority in the department. This is one of our flagship initiatives in the department. And we want to use the collaborative in a way that brings our contractors, our prime contractors, our DBEs, the unions, all our training organizations, all these stakeholder groups together to try to have a model workforce and DBE program in our state and in our country. And so this past year, we took several months off. The effort was stalled briefly, where we had to build some relationships within the collaborative. We hired a mediator to help us. A third-party mediator was brought in to build some relationships that were critical to the success of the collaborative. We've done that, and since then we've been meeting monthly. And I think the people that are working very hard on this issue are working in good faith to really address some of the critical issues here. We're looking at the on-the-job training programs, on-the-job training tracking retention, mentor-protege programs, and other ideas and concepts that we can integrate within our contract administration mechanism. So we're working hard to keep this in the forefront of what we do at MnDOT and trying to really address some of these issues in a transformative way so that whatever we put in place to address workforce and DBE issues, they're transformative in nature and will sustain for a long, long time. And lastly, I just want to mention three key initiatives. These are kind of unique initiatives. We in September of this year, we had an Imagination Jam at MnDOT. This was an online jam in which we asked our employees if they had ideas on how we can improve the operations at MnDOT, whether internally or externally. They can go online over the course of a week, put an idea out there. Other employees could come in and chime in on the ideas and ultimately vote on these ideas. And we conducted this jam over the course of the week, and it was all done online. And at the end of the week, we came up with some really, really good ideas from the employees on how we can better improve the efficiency of MnDOT. And these were three initiatives that came from that Imagination Jam. A workplace of choice. And this is focused on promoting well-being and development and success through recruitment, retention, and succession planning at MnDOT. And it's to provide a focus and to develop a portfolio of ideas that we can nurture and move forward within a department to make MnDOT the workplace of choice. And so we're moving forward with that initiative. We have an initiative on sustainability, and essentially we're exploring green action steps that we can take to move forward and help make what we do more green. And this whole area of sustainability, I will say to you that this has gained a lot of momentum and a lot of traction nationally. At all of our national meetings that Connie and I go to, there's always discussions about sustainability and transportation and what that means. And honestly, a lot of DOTs aren't sure what that means, but we're trying to get a handle on that. And I just was on a conference call this morning with the Rockefeller Foundation. They're trying to help DOTs develop some strategies on how to move forward with this idea of sustainability. And we're going to be hearing more and more about that in transportation. And I just wanted you to be aware of that. And we're moving out to try to address some of the situations we think can help us. And the last initiative identified through the EJM was Tech Connections. And it's pretty simple. We just want to explore how we can expand the use of technology, such as social media and all the technologies that are out there, to better connect with and engage with our customers. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair. I just want to say a quick word about the question about the Greater Minnesota Transit needs. That's a complex question. And it is addressed in the transit plan that you're going to see. The unmet need situation is addressed in there. And it's almost a subject of another complete dialogue. It's a very complex issue. But I just want to let the committee know that we have addressed it. It's in that transit plan. And we'd be happy to come back and address it further at another time.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, thank you very much. You know, you went page after page of accomplishments, and I thank you. I think you all have been doing a great job, and I keep saying it, everything from the transit plan to the state rail plan. So the fact I'm about to ask you a question about one thing doesn't touch on the 42 other things that I think you've been doing a great job on, but it's about the slide right before this, and it's about the EJAM and $30 million in state road construction money. I think there was originally $150 million, then there was $30 million, and I may be conflating two things, but can you tell me whether it's the $30 million from the state road construction fund that's being used to pay for these or other initiatives, or where has that $30 million gone?
What we did with that $30 million, it's still tied to state road construction. And, you know, we can't do anything differently than that. And it was always our intent that we would take that and still apply it to state road construction. When we started this EGM idea, one idea we had was there may be ideas that come out of here to prompt innovation that would be applicable to using state road construction dollars. What we created with that $30 million was we're calling it a Destination Innovation Fund. And the idea being that there's a lot of innovation here in our state that just needs a little money to jumpstart it. A good example is accelerated bridge construction. We know that there are a lot of techniques that we can use to accelerate bridge construction, but we need to get a few out there to jumpstart the innovation. So the SRC funding that we're using for Destination Innovation could be funding things like that, but it's always tied to SRC. And so the EJAM is not there's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation or relationship there to the SRC funds, that $30 million you're talking about. But there is with the Destination Innovation funds where we put that into to fund innovative ideas. And ultimately, all that money would be used on the state system to jumpstart innovation on the system.
Commissioner, I think we'll request your support on that particular idea with the executive branch, because there's a bill floating that will address that, and we certainly need your cooperation to sell it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. First of all, I want to commend you for moving forward on something like eImagination or the EJAM. A couple of years ago, I introduced a bill to try to get the Department of Administration to look at some creative options to get more discussion going among state employees of how they could reduce costs and save the state some dollars. And I'm guessing that with EJAM, you probably also have some ideas being submitted that would actually save the Department of Transportation some money. So if that's the case, I would first of all commend you for moving on this initiative on your own. And then second, I would encourage you to share this initiative with the other departments that you work with, and hopefully the other departments in the state can implement this and then hopefully lead to some cost savings. And then not only that, we need different ideas of how to do things differently in the state as we move forward with our budget issues in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I don't know if you're aware, and this is a talk about thinking outside the box and looking interagency. I had a bill last year that would have taken school bus transportation and made it transit. All kinds of ideas start flowing around when you think about taking the school buses that we have chasing around in our rural areas.
That's been up for about 20 years, Representative Dimmer.
Well, it's still a concept, Chair, and as we look at thinking outside the box, we may want to continue that.
No, it's an issue, and I'm glad you're pursuing it. And it's come up every time we talk transit, just about in every session, I think. We've had bills on it. Yeah. Representative Magnus?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, has the allocation of the CASAF formula to the counties been made? And if it has, or when you anticipate it being done, could you get me a copy of it? I've got four counties, and it's nice to, when they go meet with the county commissioners, to have this allocation, if you could have it for this year and what the allocations were for last year. I'd appreciate that, getting that from you. Just email it or whatever. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, it has been done, but we'll get you that information.
Thank you.
It's
mm-hmm.
Second week in January, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Any further questions or comment? Not. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking your time. We appreciate it. I'm sorry we had to cut it that short. I'm sure that didn't make you feel too bad.
Well, thank you.
Thank you again. And for the members of the committee, we have a meeting this coming Thursday, so we have public safety and the state patrol, I think that's it.
Well,
no further questions? The meeting is adjourned.